mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Today we open our series on fictional forests with a look at Dante's Inferno. If you haven't read it, you're probably nonetheless familiar with the inscription on the gate of hell: "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." The Inferno also begins with one of the most famous forests of Western culture, a forest of darkness and disorientation. Though the forest as a dangerous place appears early on in Western culture, the Inferno introduces a new archetype: fear of the forest. To discuss the Inferno, I spoke to Peter Olson, provost of North Central Michigan College. Olson has a PhD in comparative literature and taught Dante as part of a great books program at the University of Michigan and at Hillsdale College, where he was the chair of the English department. He was also introduced to me by my former guest, Chris Schaberg, as the smartest person he's ever heard talk about Dante. But before we get to my interview, a little background for those of you who haven't yet read The Inferno. The Inferno is the first part of Dante's narrative poem known as the Divine Comedy. Though the divine part was added later, Dante himself called it simply Commedia, comedy. The Commedia tells the story of a pilgrim's descent into hell, his re-emergence through purgatory, and ultimately his journey to Paradiso, or heaven. Of the three sections, Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso, the most popular is the one we'll be focusing on: the descent into hell. In the Inferno, hell is figured as 9 concentric circles, shaped as a funnel that goes down to the center of the earth. The Roman poet Virgil serves as the pilgrim's guide through hell, and later purgatory. As a person who lived in pre-Christian times, Virgil is unable to enter heaven, and thus it is Beatrice, a young woman Dante met when he and she were children and fell in love with from afar, and who died young, who will take over toward the end of Purgatorio and lead the pilgrim into heaven. As Virgil guides the pilgrim down through the circles of hell, they encounter the damned, grouped according to their sins, which become increasingly more serious the further we go, until, at the very bottom of hell, we meet the devil himself. The Commedia was written roughly between 1308 and 1320, during Dante's exile from Florence. Dante was embroiled in the political struggles of his time, marked initially by a conflict between two parties: the Guelphs, who supported the power of the Pope, and the Ghibellines, who supported the Holy Roman Emperor, and later by a split between the White Guelphs and the Black Guelphs. Dante's political career and his affiliation with the White Guelphs eventually led to his exile, and the Inferno is rife with references to this history, including the fact that a number of Dante's political enemies show up in hell. One of the groundbreaking aspects of the Commedia is that it was written in the vernacular, the spoken language of Dante's native Tuscany, by contrast with Latin, the language of the literary elite in the Middle Ages. Italian as such didn't yet exist during Dante's lifetime, nor was Italy yet a political entity. However, Dante's subsequent fame was so great that his writing in many ways shaped what became the Italian language. Finally, before we enter the Inferno, a few words on the form of the Commedia. I mentioned that it is divided into 3 parts. Each of these is further subdivided into 33 cantos, or songs, with the exception of the Inferno, which has 34, making a total of 100. The number 3, representing the Holy Trinity, is further inscribed into the verse itself, written in an interlocking 3-verse rhyme scheme known as terza rima. Here's Pete Olson on the importance of form in the Commedia.
To try to separate form from content is nearly impossible. I think those two elements are as tightly interwoven, tangled, maybe setting up the rest of our conversation here, as anywhere else I can imagine. And so I think that the interlocking structure of terza rima is something that foregrounds that from the instant the poem begins, that it's really quite impossible to pull out any line without yanking a couple of lines along with it as they tie into that metrical scheme, right? And so I joke about this a little bit because in one of the first times I was riding north from the Detroit area up to northern Michigan, a long car ride with the woman that was to become my wife, we stopped and she said, "Hey, get me a Coke." And we stopped at a gas station. I went in and came back out with a bottle of Coke. And it was clear from the moment I stepped into the car that I'd made a grievous error. And she kind of looked at me and I said, "Well, it's a Coke, right? What are you talking about?" She says, No. When I say Coke, I mean a fountain Coke with crushed ice. And it has to have the proper bricks of the mix then of syrup and soda in that. And I got to thinking, you know, in this long car ride, that became a technique of teaching poetry, that there is a certain form that is most appropriate for a particular content. And in her case, Coke wasn't Coke without being in a styrofoam cup with crushed ice. So the lyric, of course, is a much shorter form, and epic is a much longer form. But when I think about Dante in this respect, I think of the perfect marriage of styrofoam cup and crushed ice, or terza rima, and the form that at every point echoes the Trinity and echoes the underlying belief system and the underlying unity, understandability, and power that in Dante's mind, right, the Trinity exemplified.
Of course, for those of us who read Dante in translation, it's hard to appreciate that tight relationship between form and content, though you can get a feeling for it by listening to Dante in Italian, even if you don't understand the words or understand only a few of them. So I asked a friend of mine to read us the first few lines.
Inferno. Dante Alighieri, canto primo. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita. Ai, quanto a dir qual era e cosa dura, esta selva selvaggia e aspre forte che nel pensier rinnova la paura. Tant'è amara che poco è più morte, ma per trattar del ben chi vi trovai, dirò dell'altre cose chi vi ho scorte.
My friend prefers to remain anonymous, or else I would give him credit. Here is Stanley Lombardo's translation of those same lines. Needless to say, there are many English translations of Dante, but the Lombardo is the one that Pete Olson and I used for our discussion. Midway through the journey of our life, I found myself within a dark wood, for the straight way had now been lost. Ah, how hard it is to describe that wood, a wilderness so gnarled and rough, the very thought of it brings back my fear. Death itself is hardly more bitter. But to tell of the good that I found there, I will speak of the other things I saw. Here we find ourselves in the dark wood, which is very much the topic that interests us today. Maybe we should start with a very, very opening, though, the fact that we begin not with the beginning, but in the middle.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And I think, as I used to teach this, that's quite deliberate in at least two ways, right? I think it emphasizes the impossibility of maybe finding origins. We find ourselves stuck in the midst of a process which, to slow down or to isolate, does some violence to whatever has come behind and whatever goes before, right? It is of a piece as we are enmeshed in it. And we'll, I hope, talk a little bit about the literal vision that the souls in hell that Dante encounters here, you know, being able not so much to see the present moment, but they can look and see the future and they can see the past. But there is a certain blindness for the present moment in there. So I think Dante's emphasis on this moment in the middle of things, right, is establishing a bit of difference between him as the poet and him as the character in his own poem. And this is a kind of an old chestnut of how to teach Dante, is to split the Dante between the poet and the pilgrim, right? But I think there's some value there, because it's only upon reflection, I think, that we get to see what stuff means. There's a marvelous, so Bernard Knox was a wonderful classicist and has written eloquently about the Greek prefix opizo, which literally means a looking backwards. And the Greeks, of course, conceived of us walking backwards into the future, in that we can only look behind us as we move back. And I think that's a lot of what's happening there. So as, you know, as Dante says, midway along the road of not just his life, but our life.
Our
so he's
life.
Included us in this as well, right? Mm-hmm. So smack dab in the middle, no introduction, here we are.
Right. I mean, it's breathtaking in how quickly it engrosses us in the poem, right? It implicates us immediately in what is happening. And the midwayness, I mean, it's, you know, I struggle sometimes with trying to understand the medieval context, but also reading it from my context, which I'm not sure isn't helpful in its own way. But the perspective in terms of, I don't know, there's a sort of philosophical implication that comes to light for me about the perspective from which we experience reality, or from which we can understand some sense of truth, is here an embodied position, right? It's not, you're not seeing it from outside, you're seeing it from in the middle of things, in the middle of the wood, in the middle of the life. Do you see what I'm saying?
I'm not sure, but I'm loving the association. I think specifically around the word embodied, and especially as Dante steps into Charon's boat and someone notices, look, the boat sinks when he steps into it. He is quite literally still a body at this point as he makes his way through, which makes him remarkable, you know, among the shades that he's meeting. So that has an excellent clang across multiple levels. Yeah, and we are certainly locked into a perspective, are we not, you know, that is quite different than Dante's. I mean, I think one of the struggles in teaching here has always been to me to convey the sense both of unity in Dante's perspective, that, you know, things do fall into nice regular threes. It is an understandable universe once you've agreed to a couple of assumptions about divinity, right? We certainly don't, most of us don't share that, I think, much anymore.
Right.
And it's, I guess, a perspective colored with a little bit of golden light. In a way, it's like, you know, that was a time where understanding of most of what was known was still pretty possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely not the case, I think, now.
Yeah. I mean, it was an interesting aspect of the experience of reading the Dante for me, which is that there are times when I feel that distancing, that barrier. And then there are other times, almost like what's happening with the snow now, like when my dog likes to walk on the snowbanks, and she'll be able to walk, and all of a sudden she'll sink, you know, like her paw will sink. And I had that experience a little bit with the Dante too. There are moments where, like, it comes right up to the present moment.
One of the more difficult things, I think, to convey to folks is the nature of allegory itself, as opposed to an individual allusion that somebody can identify, right? When we're in the presence of such a regular structure of, I told you that story to tell you this one, mm-hmm. in allegory, right? Your analogy of the snow is wonderful, that at certain points, the crust or the bridge over the crevasse remains intact, but at other points you break through into something else.
A note on allegory, or as Pete describes it, I told you this story to tell you that one. Allegory was a common literary figure in the Middle Ages. It was also a practice of reading, notably in the way the Bible was read. When we read the Inferno, there is always that sense of layers of meaning. Think of a layered cake. So that while Dante captures the literal experience of being lost in a dark wood, the dark wood is at the same time a figure for other kinds of disorientation.
Those moments when he comes most close to, when you feel most close to his medieval perspective, have you noticed where those are? Is there a pattern to where that closeness really snaps in place and other places where it's difficult?
Well, one of the places is how he uses these metaphors taken from the natural world a lot. So there's one that I wrote down. Let me see if I can find it. So this is from Canto 11. It's not. Sorry. It's from Canto 22, looking at a different part. In the eighth circle of hell, when the sinners are engulfed in pitch. So he has these incredible metaphors. So he says, as dolphins breach and arch their backs, signaling mariners in the high seas to take precautions to save their ships, so too sometimes one of the sinners, to lessen his pain, would show his back and then hide it quicker than a lightning flash. And as at the edge of water in a ditch, frogs sit with only their muzzles exposed, submerging their feet and the rest of their bulk, so were the sinners on each side of this ditch. So, I mean, you bring up allegory, which I think is something to talk about. You know, maybe this is sort of a naive way to put it, but I feel like any symbolic imagery is only really potent when the imagery itself is really good. You know what I mean? He uses the natural world in many ways to shape, like the landscape. That's another place that struck me. He uses landscape to construct this descent into hell. And it's often in these very vivid terms where you can actually imagine, you know, taking the step. So I thought that was very interesting.
Well, I think you're 1,000% right about how the architecture with deliberate doubling or tripling on that word is as much the story as anything else. I mean, we can certainly talk. We've talked a little bit about the literal poetic architecture in Terzerima, right? But it's also the structure, the geography, if you like, of hell and purgatory and the Empyrean in heaven itself. Those are all absolutely essential players in the drama that's going on in front of us. And if you think about, I mean, it's ultimately, I think, at least with the geography of hell, I've always thought it's an extraordinarily hopeful geography in that if, as you descend, as Dante and Virgil descend deeper into a very large pit, and as those sins increase in severity as they drop down, the hopefulness to me comes from the fact that the outermost rim of that pit will be the largest in circumference. Mm-hmm. So if it's the largest in circumference, that means that there are the most number of people guilty of a lesser sin as you deepen and the circumference diminishes to the point that is the center, right, of Lucifer's body. You know, true evil is horrible, certainly, but it's not as widely populated, I'll say that, right? I mean, it's simply less populous than those at the outer edges. And that's, I think, a very hopeful geography that is ever present in this. I mean, right down to the fact where, you know, Dante pays very careful attention to which foot is beneath the other as they are circling down this inside of a funnel, for example, is the usual way to describe right. it as you deepen, right? So absolutely, I'd say that the natural landscape, you know, is a function exactly yeah. of what's going on
and
there.
And it operates, you know, going back to the sense of allegory, it operates as part of a larger structure that has meaning on more than one level. But it, at the same time, it has this immediacy. It has, again, this sort of embodied immediacy where you are aware of the pilgrim's gravity. You know, you're aware of the effort that it takes to make these steps and to not fall. And let's go back to the dark wood. So midway through the journey of our life, I found myself within a dark wood, for the straight way had now been lost. So the first thing we know about the dark wood is that it's contrasted with the straight way. So being in the wood is a state of being lost. What else can we say about the wood?
Well, I think there are two tensions there. I think there's obviously the play of light in this, right? I mean, it's a selva oscura, right? The English dark doesn't quite convey the Romance sense of obscurity or the fact that light has been prevented from reaching somewhere. It's not just a dark wood where somebody switched off the light, but mm-hmm. you're thinking about the someone who switched off the light, right? It has been obscured. And I think that brings with it the complex of understanding surrounding light. The light enables the apprehension of form, right? And so that to me is embedded in dirita, right? It's mi ritrovai. And again, it's the English word, you know, I found myself. It really misses the ritrovai component of that. It wasn't just I found myself. I found myself again, ritrovai, within a dark wood in which you hear the word direct, right? Che la dritta via, the straight road, the direct way, the fastest way from A to B had been lost. And I think the tension there is, are you trying to get from A to B as quickly as possible, or are you wandering around without sufficient light to get where you're going? This wood in particular is darkness. You know, the next, and the translation is a little bit interesting in the fifth line when Dante says how hard it is to describe that wood, a wilderness so gnarled and rough. The Italian beneath that, of course, is a selva selvaggio. It's a wood, but it's a a trackless or a wild wood. And I think it's fair to hear the English clang in that selvage, even though that's a Dutch root. I think selvaggio, selva selvaggio, is that word that you're headed for, I think, with wilderness in that. And what really is that? Is it a, you know, by whose will does this wood operate? And it's clearly a different will than the will that follows the straight path.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that sense of wilderness, I think of it in a kind of ancient sense as being contrasted with the human realm. And yet here it's sort of used to characterize what it means to be human in a sense. The retrouvai, the I found myself again. It's sort of like, oh, here I am again. You know, lost in a dark wood, as I want to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I do. You know, there's that wonderful, if I remember his name, wonderful scholar of the New England Puritans, Perry Miller, who described the Puritan sort of march through life as wandering on a plain in the darkness, remembering the burned image on their retinas of the path ahead illuminated only occasionally by lightning. So imagine, you know, walking through a dark place with no light at all, and then a flash of lightning, and the image of the path ahead of you remains somehow on your retina with your eyes closed. You're aware there, but the light is gone again, and you're back into this darkness. And I think I've thought often of Miller's description of that, you know, as Dante comes to himself again in this wood. It's still very dark in there, but where it shifts to me, I think, is really in line 8. If you go just a little bit farther there, a wilderness so gnarled and rough that the very thought of it brings back my fear. Yeah, don't want to go back in the darkness. Don't want to go back into the area where there's a will of another, right? I guess I hear will in there someplace. Death itself is hardly more bitter. But this line, but to tell of the good that I found there, I will speak of the other things I saw. I think those lines are absolutely critical because, I mean, that's the whole justification for it being a comedy, right? Since it came to good. I think you mentioned that you had read John Chardy's translation frequently of this. If I remember, Chardy's translation of that line 8 is, but since it came to good, I'll speak of the other things I saw at that point. That tells you that, you know, he's been through this and it turned out okay. And perhaps there's a point to following him through this wilderness that it will be worth your time, you know, and it's ultimately, again, it's a little optimistic. It's certainly consoling. We're not just lost here alone. We got through it. And I think you would forget that as the more we engage in, you know, Dante the pilgrim as Dante, the hero of his own story, the more we're with him side by side being scared, we forget the outside. We forget the formal component of this, which is this is a recollection. He knows where this is coming out, and it's going to be okay.
And he tells us that in a sense with the title as well.
Yeah, exactly correct.
I want to go back to the fear for a moment.
Of course.
What is it about the wood that is so terrifying that makes it hard for him even to find the words to describe this terror? And I think it's important, too, because even though it may not be directly related, this is a representation of the wood as a place of fear that will then echo through endless books and movies after that.
Yeah, certainly there's a fear of stumbling against something in the darkness, right? I mean, at its simplest level, if you can't see where your feet are going, you're likely to drop into a hole or you're likely to stub your toe, right? But if we expand outward a little bit from that, is the lack of light emblematic, suggestive of a lack of reason, a lack of a clear path going forward? And that's an emotion, I think, at our most fearful, we are least able to reason. We are reacting solely with our limbic systems, right? With the portion of our bodies that is pre-rational. And I think that's kind of the fear that may be possessing Dante. He doesn't want to, with his own choice, put himself back into a realm where the light of reason enhanced by divine intervention can't reach him. He has the choice. Virgil did not, right? Virgil is condemned to the ring of the shades, or the ring of the of those who lived before Christ. You know, he didn't have the choice. Dante has the choice. So how to make the right choice is a heck of a lot more important to Dante than it was to Virgil. So the stakes of the game, I guess the better way to say it, the stakes of the game are much higher. So there's that fear of making a mistake. And I guess that ties back to, I think Gary Snyder talks so eloquently about the origins of the word wilderness being tied up with, you know, that place where will is unfettered, where there are undomesticated things, right? Where one's will can roam unimpeded, along with every other being out there that can roam unimpeded with that. So I think there's that fear that he's in a place where reason may not apply, where it's the constraints of something else.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. I had another association, which is completely anachronistic, but I'll bring it up nonetheless.
Those are good.
One of the contrasts is with this idea of a path, having lost one's path. It made me think of, and I think this is just one of those passages that has been a touchstone for me, at the very end of A Room with a View, there's, I think it's Mr. Emerson is talking to Lucy Honeychurch, who has lost her way. You know, she's fallen in love with his son and is engaged to somebody else, and she's just made a mess of things. And he says, take an old man's word, there's nothing worse than a muddle in all the world. A muddle being a sort of a not very elegant version of this kind of confusion. It is easy to face death and fate and the things that sound so dreadful. It is on muddles that I look back with horror. And so basically what he's saying is that, like, it's when you start lying to yourself, you know, when you are sort of in a knot of deceit, that is what one really has to fear, that the things that we think of as fearful are not the most terrifying. And I don't know, that came to mind for me.
That's super interesting. So muddle then conveys with it, muddle bears in it the notion of the anti-straight. In a way, it is a twisted, convoluted back upon itself. So the way out of a muddle, he's explaining this, I couldn't help but remember, to Lucy.
Yes. Yeah.
To someone full of light.
To a young person who, you know, is about to embark on what should be a comedy, right? What should end with the right marriage, but is potentially not going to, because she's gotten herself into a muddle. And the muddle there is like, it's an internal state of affairs as much as anything else.
That's super, super interesting. But again, if the light were only there, I mean, that's one of the questions that students always ask, right? Is, and it's one of the genius things about the Inferno to me is, if you're actually sinking into a pit in the earth, right? Where is the light coming from?
That's a good point.
Right? I mean, how do you see where you're putting your damn feet? and so it's always intriguing to me that Dante will bring up the reflected light, you know, off of a fire somewhere, or the reflected light ultimately down in the very most pit of hell, the reflected light off the ice, and how light reflected off ice is the absolute inversion of the heat of light. There's light there, but there's no warmth. There is, you're at the farthest possible point from the warmth of love or understanding that might draw you upward, right? That's always seemed so apt in that.
So I don't want to move past Canto 1 without talking about the three beasts. The three beasts. As the pilgrim progresses through the wood, he arrives at the end of a valley where he sees a hill lit by the sun's rays. This calmed a little the lake of my heart that had surged with terror all through the night, the poet tells us. He starts to climb upward toward the light, an ascension that is at once physical and allegorical, a movement towards the light of reason, of clarity of thought, perhaps of truth. But the pilgrim finds his path blocked by three animals, a leopard that prowls all swift and light and covered with a rippling spotted hide, a lion, and a she-wolf. A traditional reading says that the three beasts are allegories of three different sins, the leopard of lust, the lion pride, and the wolf avarice. But there's nothing in the text that requires this interpretation, and Pete Olson and I agreed this seems a little too simple.
Of course, I'm cheating because I understand the rest of your fascination, or some of the rest of your fascination, with wolves, but I think it's not the least bit insignificant, very significant then, right? Then he has got the most trouble with the wolf, right? Mm-hmm. With the sense that here is the animal that at the time would have been much more, I think, in the minds of his contemporaries, right, as a threat than a lynx or certainly a lion. I think he's tapping into some very deep senses of the inversion of a human society, that this is now a pack hanging on greedily, avariciously to whatever it can get, rather than sharing the wealth among the members of the pack, or however we think about wolves today, mm-hmm. right? I think the fact that his wife's family was precisely the sort of mercantile-driven, institutionalized capitalism, if you like, right, of Florence at the time, was very troubling to him. And I think that he's wrestling with what is the correct path to take, given the corruption of a pope and the corruption of an emperor. And how does one live one's life? To whom does one pay one's tithe at that mm-hmm. point? How do you carve out the middle way between those kinds of pulls? And are you loyal to your family? But if that's the case, what does that entail with your loyalty potentially to God, to Christ? I think that he recognizes that he's not at this point capable of moving through this landscape alone. Mm-hmm. And I mean that obviously metaphorically too, right? I mean, he can't see well enough to get out of this. He is too consumed by his fear in each of these areas, but certainly most consumed by the fear of avarice or greed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, if he's writing this indeed from exile, give or take around 1308, then, you know, he has been tossed out of his native land by, you know, precisely the people that were ascribing their loyalty initially more to the emperor, but now to those, you know, seeking a little more liberal interpretation of papal authority mm-hmm. at that point as well.
And so, and it's precisely after his encounter with the wolf. What is the Italian? Because it says she-wolf. Una lupa.
I think it's Luca.
Yeah. That then he meets Virgil, right? So
correct.
It's a real point of despair there, to where the sun is mute. But what's interesting is, like, you know, as you say, he feels that he can't go forward, and he's trying to go up, right, towards the sun. And then he meets Virgil, and Virgil will explain to him, in reference to, again, to the, I presume it's to the wolf, he says, "Look at the beast that makes me turn back. Save me from her, glorious sage, for she fills me with fear and makes my blood pound." And then Virgil says to him, "You will have to go by another road. If you want to escape the wilderness," he's going to have to go down rather than go up towards the sun. So I'm interested specifically in the wilderness in that particular context. Again, it's not just a wilderness. It's, you know, operating on different levels, but what does it mean to escape the wilderness, and what do we make of the fact that, no, he can't go up towards the sun, he has to go down, he has to descend into the middle of the earth?
Yeah, I think I'd go back to a couple lines just after the ones where you began. So at around 61 or 62 or so, still in Canto 1, right, while I was scrambling down, again, this is part of, I think, his power that he keeps hammering us with. I'd almost call this synesthetic quality. You're mixing sense data, and as you deepen into the reading, that unfamiliar mixing of sense data doesn't feel unfamiliar at all. It feels exactly right. So, for example, when he says, "Advancing always the reckless beast, restless beast, she kept pushing me back little by little to where the sun is mute," we don't typically think of light in sound categories. I mean,
right.
Post-Feynman we do, I think, right? But we don't typically think of sun in sound. "While I was scrambling down to those depths, a figure presented itself to my eyes," and does it again, hammers it home again, "one who appeared to be faint, visual, through long silence." Mm-hmm. He's hammered that again, that mm-hmm. there's that mixing of both of these senses. But the next line is one I really wanted to head to. "When I saw him in that vast and trackless waste, to me, that's, again, the opposite of the Rita Via, right? Mm-hmm. There is no clear path in this. That's the fear, that there is no way out of this. And I think the point is, with Dante's unassisted reason, there is no way out of this. Mm-hmm. He's not going to do it without intervention from somewhere else. Right. So in this respect, the wilderness is the wilderness of a will uninformed by something from outside. Mm-hmm. And the inversion is even nicer, isn't it? I mean, it is one's will is the most important thing. One must choose the correct path, but one's will alone is not sufficient. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, the medieval perspective that you referred to, or you may have been referring to earlier, that's so difficult for us moderns, is I think we're accustomed to believe that, as Joyce would say, by thinking about things, you could understand them, right? And that's not so much the case here. You can think all day about this, and without the downcoming of the light from ultimately Mary to Lucia to Beatrice, without that downcoming intervention for Dante in the form of light, he's not going to make it. He's not going to get out of there. There has to be another way than the way that he would come up with on his own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea that, like, that you can't get out of the dark wood all by yourself.
You can't, you know, at least to Dante. And that may be one of the real gulfs between his mind and ours. I think many of us in a post-romantic world don't automatically feel fear in a wilderness. I think many of us feel comfort in that place, having identified danger as a product of humans, more so than a product of the natural environment.
I think that's true, but what interests me is I think that in a cultural way, we still hold on to that association of fear and the forest. Fear and the forest. If Canto 1 sets a precedent for what will become a familiar topos, Google in a dark wood and you'll see what I mean. Another forest of the Inferno that we encounter in Canto 13 is even spookier. In the seventh circle of hell, where Virgil and the pilgrim Dante encounter those who have committed sins of violence, they cross the River of Blood, where they meet tyrants, brigands, murderers, and the like, up to their eyebrows in hot blood. After a centaur named Nessus helps them cross the river, they find themselves in a tangled forest, the Forest of the Suicides. I start by reading the opening of Canto 13. You'll hear my dog Coco chiming in on occasion. Nor had Nessus reached the other shore when we stepped into a brooding wood that was not marked by any trail. So, in a sense, it's evoking the pathless wood that we open with.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly, correct.
And then we have these contrasts that are marked by negation. No leaves of green there, but rather of dusk. No branches grown smooth, but gnarled and twisted. No fruits cluster there, rather poisonous thorns. Nor do wild beasts live in brush so thick and rough, not even those that abhor the tilled fields, and so on. But instead, it's where the harpies nest, those foul creatures who drove the Trojans from the Strophads, et cetera, et cetera. Just a moment. She's not happy with the harpies, apparently.
I wouldn't be either. There would be nightmares in my house.
I mean, talk about a spooky wood. So before we get into the bleeding bushes, do you have any thoughts about the parallels here between the pathless wood in the opening and the sense of a wood not marked by any trail? So again, it's a wood that, I mean, here sort of ironically, again, it's associated with humans, but it's sort of by definition a wood where no humans have been, no trails, right? Nothing living in it.
Yeah,
in a sense.
I think one of the key things that's happening there is even deeper into the darkness than we had been farther up, right? I think the repetition, it's not green, the branches are not smooth, there is no fruit, there aren't even any wild beasts here. I think that's a stripping away of the usual categories of understanding, even in darkness, right? I mean, I think it's that progressive stripping. But I think now you're not talking about similes anymore, right? You're talking about metonymies. And by that, I mean, what you've shifted on here is not two figures like doves or as starlings move through an area.
Here, Pete Olson is referencing Canto 5, where Dante uses a series of metaphors of birds to represent the plight of two adulterous lovers.
Not as cranes might sort of kind of resemble a human. Now you've got a bird woman, impossible to separate, right? These are not birds that you know anything about. You've entered a realm now where the borderline between the human and the animalistic is fluid. That image of the harpy as female and avian, human female and avian somehow, is the marker, the signpost for what's about to happen. It's the perversion, I guess.
Right. There are other similar forms in this kind of middle section of the Inferno, mm-hmm. the Minotaur, for instance. So I'm just going to read the descriptions just so that we have that in our head. They have wide wings because he's always, these images are so powerful, and that's part of what makes it so compelling. They have wide wings, human necks and faces, taloned feet, and great feathered bellies. Perched in the strange trees, they croak their laments. So then he's confused because he hears voices, but he doesn't see anyone and he doesn't know what's going on. And so Virgil says to him, "If you will pluck even a little branch from one of the trees, your present thoughts will all be cut short." And he stretches out his hand and snaps off a twig from a great thorn bush, and it cries out, "Why do you break me?" Then, after it had become dark with blood, it cried out again, "Why do you tear me? Do you have no spirit of pity at all?" So it turns out that, again, a hybrid form, right? You have these humans that have taken on the form of trees and bushes that nonetheless can speak, nonetheless can bleed human blood. And this is the punishment that suits those who have committed suicide. How do you make sense of that? Why is this the appropriate punishment for them?
I'll go at it a couple ways. In one respect, I'll say it's the ultimate perversion or the ultimate negation of what it means to be a human is to take one's life, right? If our vitality is what makes us most who we are, to abrogate our will to the point where we take our own lives. In other words, I'll say that a little better. To use our will in such a perverse fashion, in the literal sense of turning off the road fashion, right? Mm-hmm. If we use our will in that perverse a fashion, this is the result. It's the negation of that physical body.
Well, and it's playing God too, right? Well, taking God's
creation. Well, it's not, right, it's not man's to do, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not,
right,
it's not
right.
But I think there's more to it. So this is so clearly a moment where Virgil's teaching him, right? I mean, Dante's confused. He can't understand where these voices are coming from. And so Virgil, on the one hand, is peeling back the curtain to say, okay, you know, snap off that branch and you'll figure out what's going on here. So number one, it's a sort of a, you know, Virgil as guide, but it's also Virgil as moral guide, because the story that's going to get told will encourage Dante toward a type of behavior, not just learn what's happening here, but encourage a type mm-hmm. of behavior, pay more attention to honor the physical body more. And I think that superimposition also reflects Dante's revision of Virgil in this. Mm-hmm. In other words, when this scene shows up in the Aeneid, or a scene like this that shows up in the Aeneid, right, it's clear. Not only does Virgil understand what's going on here because he's been through hell before, right? But because he's included similes, one thing like another like this, before, back in the Aeneid. So when Aeneas, you know, fetches up on a certain portion of ground in which a hero has been buried and a bush is growing out of the ground above the buried hero, the bush bleeds. And the sense is that in the same way that a bush would draw nourishment from the moisture in the soil beneath it, the blood that comes from the broken branch in the Aeneid is somehow the blood of the hero buried beneath. But this is not that. This is modified because it's not now simply bush as channel for vital fluid coming up from the hero beneath. This is the bush is the figure. There is no separation anymore, in the same way that the harpies are simultaneously bird and human. This is simultaneously a bush and simultaneously a human. It can speak, but the simile of a green stalk in line 40, a green firebrand with flames at one end and hot sap dripping out from the other, will hiss as the air within it escapes. So too from that broken twig, words and blood oozed out together. That's the key dimension of the identification that marks, I think, Dante's transition away from Virgil. Virgil is maybe a master of simile, right? Dante at this point is, in the quite literal sense, the master of metaphor or metonymy. There is not just a like relationship between these, there's an identification between these two things. And so the punishment is, again, perfectly suited to the crime if you so dismiss the nature of your physical body, you will become your physical body in the afterlife. I think this is the place where Dante, you know, executes one of his turns away from Virgil, demonstrating the power of being a 14th century individual, where he can say, no, the important thing is not to deny the gift of the human body. The important thing is to celebrate that. And in so doing, you celebrate Dante's conception of Christ as man.
Right. Yeah.
Where Virgil would be unable to do that pre-Christian. Virgil's similes are of necessity just similes. Dante's can be identification metaphors. Man can be something else.
Yeah. Well, to bring up Christ seems appropriate here as well, right?
On the tree.
The crucifixion obviously seems to kind of loom
exactly.
Here as well. Yeah.
It does. It does, because as these with the second coming, right, these all these shades will bring their bodies back and hang them from these bushes at the end. That's the real tight image at the end. So the near the end of, where is it? I think it's toward the end of this canto.
Are you talking about that the hanging?
Yeah,
of the body?
It's on it. It's so about line 12.
Yeah, it's around 106. We will drag our bodies here to hang in this mournful wood, each on the thorn bush of its malignant shade.
Yeah. In a sense, they will each be crucified in the same way. Yeah.
Right. Well, and at the very end, too, there's this, I turned my house into my gallows tree. So that I think that might be part of the punishment fits the crime aspect of it, too. You know,
100%.
Yeah. So the tree as the instrument of death and becoming that instrument of death itself.
In the Inferno, Dante gives us two powerful representations of the forest. One of a forest that is a recognizable part of the natural world, defined as separate from civilization, and at the same time, a figure for what it means to be lost as a human, whether being lost means a midlife crisis or a moral or religious sense of losing one's path. In the Forest of the Suicides, that melding of the human and the natural world takes a more extreme form. What does all of this tell us about the role of the forest in the Western imagination and the role of Dante's legacy? Well, what I'm struck by is the ways in which Dante's wood is at once a wood and not a wood, as though a wood can't help but be charged with symbolic significance. Also, the way the natural world is at once a foil for the human realm and a representation of it. This push-pull is a recurrent feature of fictional forests of Western culture, one that I would argue is still at work today. We still imagine that there is a frontier between our human realm and the wilderness, even if ecologists have long challenged that distinction. And I suspect that we still project lots of our fears, and also our hopes, dreams, onto the forest. Next time, we'll continue our series on fictional forests. I'll be talking to the writer and scholar Ellen Handler Spitz about the forests of fairy tales, as well as Sondheim and Lapine's reconfiguring of those fairy tales in their musical Into the Woods. If you'd like to share a favorite fictional forest with me, email me at askwith.intheweeds@gmail.com or tweet me at intheweedspod. We'll be back soon.